Good evening. The meeting will come to order. Clerk will note the roll. There is a quorum. Members, we have the minutes of March 30th before us. Are there any corrections, additions? Representative Carlson moves approve the minutes. Seeing no corrections or additions, all in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Okay, members, we've got two items on our agenda tonight. The Omnibus Jobs Bill and the Omnibus State Government Bill. We're going to take up the Omnibus Jobs Bill first. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I would move that Senate File 1937 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register, and I would like to move that the House language be inserted into the Senate file.
Okay, this is a procedural motion to substitute the House file language for 2209 into Senate File 1937. Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The House language is substituted. Representative Garofalo, why don't you present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. And would it be okay if I move some of the amendments first so I can...
If you want to, yes. Do you want to move the A5 amendment? I think that's an author's amendment.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman. I'll move that amendment.
Okay. Representative Garofalo moves the A5 author's amendment. Representative Garofalo.
And Mr. Chairman and members, first of all, as it conforms to our intent to get the spreadsheet to match up to what we... have the language match the spreadsheet that was in committee. In addition, right after we passed the bill, we received a fiscal note for the voiceover IP provisions. So to make sure that the bill is not over target, we make budget adjustments to correct for that. In addition, there was an error in the total appropriation for the TAM transfer that was included in there. Also, one of the provisions we did is we eliminated the rider language for the energy-intensive trade exposed appropriation for assessments for utilities. Because we're getting rid of it, we put it at zero. We're just deleting it out of the bill. In addition, what we do is we conform with our intent is that we're combining the fast track and adult workforce competitive grant programs, not only the general fund appropriations, but also the workforce development funds into one competitive grant. So it accomplishes that, and I'm happy to answer any questions if people have them.
Okay, and Mr. March, I understand you have a technical amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, I believe there are a couple corrections that should be made in the amendment on page 2, line 23. This paragraph and a paragraph on the next page set a base, and the base should be set for 20 and 21 rather than 18 and 19. So on line 2.23, the 2018 should be 2020, sorry. And the next line, 24, 2019, should be 2021. And then on the next page, page 3.5, 2018 should be 2020. And 3.6, 2019 should be 2021, I believe.
And Mr. Chairman, I would incorporate those into my amendment, if I may.
You may. Anything else, Mr. March?
Not that I'm aware of, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Discussion to the A5 amendment. Any discussion to the A5 amendment? Representative Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, I think I'd like a little more explanation. I see there's quite a bit of shifting of dollars around in the amendment, and I was trying to follow the latest changes, but maybe if Representative Garofalo could comment a bit about some of the shifting around. I'm just trying to figure what the net here is.
Sure. Representative Garofalo, is there a particular part that you're interested in?
Well, there's a series of
At the bottom of page 1 and going to the page 2.
The job creation fund from $6.5 million to $5 million. Telecommunications Office Department of Commerce from almost $2 million to $977 and so on. I just would like to know how those are netting out and I guess the why of some of those fiscal changes.
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, regarding your first question, what is happening is the job creation fund is being reduced from $6.5 million to $5 million in fiscal years 19 and 20. This is conforming those changes to the tails to make sure the tails are the same amount. With regards to the reductions you're seeing in the Department of Commerce, as I stated before, when we received, right when we were taking up the bill, we received a fiscal note on the voice over IP re-regulation provisions, which resulted in a reduction in revenue to the Public Utilities Commission and the Department of Commerce. So this makes accommodations for that so we're not over our target.
And Mr. Chairman, was the shrimp production in your amendment?
Representative Rockwell.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, that is being removed from the bill in this amendment.
In this amendment, that's being removed. Mr. Chairman, I think I'd like a roll call on this particular amendment.
Okay. Representative Carlson requests a roll call on the A5 amendment. Other discussion to the A5 amendment. Representative Garofalo, do you have some more words on it since Representative Carlson asked for a roll call? I want to recognize you before we take the roll.
No, I think this conforms the bill to my intent, and I'm not sure why there's a roll call, but I would ask members to vote in favor of the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'm a little bit concerned about the shifts with those numbers. I asked about the shrimp just for a matter of curiosity if that was in or out, but what I'm really concerned about being where a fiscal committee is what some of those shifts and reductions actually mean to the various programs and the agencies that are in the amendment. So that's the reason.
Okay. Representative Garofalo?
Again, Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, if there's any specific lines you can point to in the bill, I'm happy to highlight those, but I think the ones you mentioned to me, I've answered those questions.
Okay. Any other questions for other discussion? Okay, seeing none, the clerk will take the roll on the A5 amendment.
Yeah. Representative Nava?
Aye.
Representative Vogel?
Yes.
Representative Carlson?
No.
Representative Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Baker?
Aye.
Representative Cornish?
Aye.
Representative Davids?
Aye.
Representative Dean?
Aye.
Representative Detmer?
Aye.
Representative Draskowski?
Aye.
Representative Fabian? Representative Garofalo?
Aye.
Representative Gunther?
Aye.
Representative Hamilton?
Pass.
Representative Houseman?
No.
Representative Hillstrom?
No.
Representative Hornstein?
No.
Representative Liebling?
No.
Representative Varun?
Yes.
Representative Marquardt?
No.
Representative Murphy?
No.
Representative Nornes?
Yes.
Representative Pulowski? Representative Poppy? Representative Torkelson?
Aye.
Representative Erdoff?
Yes, but I still like shrimp.
Representative Borgunius?
No. There being 14 ayes and 8 nays, the motion prevails and the A5 amendment is adopted. Okay, Representative Garofalo, I think you also have an author's amendment, the A3 amendment.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman. I'll move the... As soon as I find it here. Oh, the A3 amendment. I'll move that now, Mr. Chairman. And what that is in this bill we have language pertaining to the Volkswagen settlement money. We want to make sure that the legislative and executive branches are both at the table when deciding this. However, the language as it's currently written could possibly exclude, prohibit, local units of government and private industries from applying for a separate pot of money that's involving the Volkswagen settlement. We don't want to do that. That was not our intent, so this fixes that problem.
A discussion to the A3 amendment. Representative Carlson.
Just to make sure, Mr. Chairman, there was some very specific requirements with the courts with the Volkswagen agreement, and are we on sound footing with the language that you have in the bill and with this, which appears to be somewhat minor?
Representative Ruffalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, I think that there's a dispute about the legislation that's in there, the language that's in the bill. It was never my intent nor the committee's intent to impact those separate settlements of funds that private individuals, private groups, and local units of government can apply for. It was only to have it applied to the state side of things. So the substance of that bill there is still disagreement on, but pertaining to the private individuals, local units of government, this corrects that problem so that the dispute in this legislation is only focused on the money that's available to the state of Minnesota.
Yeah, and that's, Mr. Chairman, what I'm referring to is the money available to the state. I don't think we even have a role, do we, relative to the private individuals.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Carlson, it was not our intent with the language we put in there to impact that. There was a concern that the language as it was originally drafted could impact that, that somehow the legislature would have to authorize that separate pot of funds. That was not our intent, so we're just doing this based on that advice and removing it.
Representative Guidance.
Thank you. I think just to be clear, the controversy still remains. If the language in the bill, even as amended, were to go forward, then Minnesota would not be eligible for the dollars because the governor has to certify to the trustee that what the PUC does is legally binding. And if the legislature is going to supersede what PCA does, the governor can't make that certification. So while the amendment may cure a small problem, it does not cure the fundamental problem.
Yeah, and Representative Carlson.
And Mr. Chairman, that's what I was trying to clarify. So the fundamental problem still remains in the bill then.
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, you may view it as a problem. I view it as a feature that the executive and legislative branches need to reach agreement before a formal application is submitted to the settlement board. So I don't view that as a problem, but you may view it that way.
Mr. Chairman, there's a fairly significant amount of money on the table here, and as I understand it, and I'm not an expert on it, what I know is basically what I've read in the paper and a few conversations in the House. I'm not on your committee, but there was some concern that we have to follow the rules set down by the courts, and that's why I raised the question to make sure that as this moves forward then, that we're not putting ourselves in a situation where we put, trying to remember, I think it's isn't it like something like $60 million or whatever that?
47.
I think it's 47.
47. Big amount of money either way. That we not put that at risk.
Representative Ruffalo?
Well, again, there's a difference of opinion on the subject matter, but the amendment before you just makes sure that we're not impacting those other grants.
Okay. Any other discussion to the 8th amendment? Representative Rudlin.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Garofalo, I'm not sure it is really just a difference of opinion. I'm not sure we're really all understanding, or at least let me say it this way. I'm a little confused between what you're saying and what Representative Wagenius is saying, and all I know about this is what I'm hearing from people, you know, here on the floor and whatever. So, I get that you're saying that you want there to be an agreement about how the money is spent, but I think what she's saying, and someone correct me if I'm wrong, but I think what she's saying is that when it comes from the federal government, the governor has to certify right away how it's going to be spent, and that if you have this in here where there has to be an appropriation, that would be an agreement that would come later on. And so it can't be both. It's got to be one or the other. So, I mean, could we, sure. Is my understanding correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, you are wrong about what Representative Wagenius is wrong about. So let me just say, first of all, these are settlement proceeds. These are not funny money from the federal government. The department is interpreting this is this reference and this is a gift. And so there's a disagreement of opinion here, a separation of powers issue about whether the legislative branch is involved in the decision-making on this or whether we're not involved. I am not going to debate that today. That's a difference of opinion on it. We can address it at a future point. The amendment before you, just make sure that the separate pot of money that really is up to Volkswagen how they allocate, that we didn't want to put legislative approval on that separate pot of money. It was only for the money that's coming directly to the state of Minnesota.
Right. I got that part, Mr. Chair. Sorry. I got that part of it, Representative Garofalo. So I think your amendment... We're on the amendment. The amendment, I don't see a problem with that as such.
Right.
But, but the larger issue, I just think it's got to be one or the other and not both. And maybe at some point as we go to the floor with this, somebody could point out, you know, I don't know if it's a court opinion where this was written or I don't know and where we would find the actual language that would tell us which it is because it can't be both.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. It's a trust agreement, and the court has Northern District of California District Court has written a trust agreement, and so the trustee has to follow what the court is saying. And so, I've read the agreement. I'll give you a copy of it.
All right. Thank you.
Seeing no further discussion on the A3 amendment, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion fails. The A3 amendment is adopted. Okay, next members will take up the A14 amendment. The chair will move the A14 amendment. Members, the A14 amendment is an amendment I don't think has much controversy to me. It was brought to me by Representatives Barr and Pepin, and it relates to unclaimed property the Department of Commerce has. And apparently right now there is a policy of some sort that says that if an estate has unclaimed property, they need to present and give the entire will or trust to the Department of Commerce, which they then keep and explore as to whether they feel that the property in question should be then given to the estate. What this language would do, and I'm going to make an oral deletion to the A14 amendment and take out lines 14 through 16 because of the reference to section 13. What it does is basically says that you only have to present that part of the will or trust document that pertains to the particular property in question. You know, it's the responsibility of the executor or trustee to make sure that an estate is administered correctly, and I don't think we really need to have an entire person's will or trust documents given to the department, and then, while this isn't really part of it, be at this point potentially available to the public. So that's the A14 amendment. Any questions? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're moving an oral amendment to delete line 1.14 through 1.16. Is that
I am, yes. I'm incorporating that into my A14 amendment. Oh, I'm told by counsel that it's drafted to the wrong page. Mr. Sullivan, can you give me some help on that?
And Mr. Chair and members, I think the A14 amendment needs to be modified on page 1, line 2. Delete line 2 and insert in its place page 151 after line 33 insert.
Okay, I'll incorporate that into my amendment as well. Other discussion to the A14 amendment? See no discussion. All in favor of the A14 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The A14 amendment is adopted. Okay. And members, I will also offer the A13 amendment. Members, in the bill, there is some language that restricts the granting of the job creation fund to only those counties with above-average unemployment. And I think we should be targeting these funds perhaps more narrowly than we have in the past. But I also think that there are other economic metrics that might also be considered. And so this language says that it's also available for counties in which the average weekly wage is less than the state average. And this, I think, would be, it would open up some more counties to the job creation funds, and I think this is a relevant amendment in terms of an additional consideration that should be granted when granting these funds. So is there any discussion of the A13 amendment? I'm sorry, it's Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, when all is said and done, how many counties are left out?
You know, Representative Carlson, I don't know if I know the answer to that. I think the majority, the great majority of the counties in Minnesota would be eligible underneath either the language that is in the amendment now, or in the bill now, or with this language.
Mr. Chairman, may, perhaps if I could pose that question to Representative Garofalo.
Sure. Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, if the committee were to adopt the non-block language, I just know that the restrictions would be in place for fewer counties. I do not know the number of counties, though.
Well, Mr. Chairman, as the bill originally came in, it was my understanding that there were a significant number of counties that would not be eligible. So your amendment adds how many counties, then? Do you have any idea with that, Representative Knobloch? Actually, the name I had down for the maker of the amendment was Garofalo, but...
I'm kind of going back and forth here. My guess would be there'd probably a couple more dozen counties that would be eligible underneath this language, but I don't have the exact number for you.
Mr. Chairman, maybe you or the author of the bill could have better information on that then for us when the bill hits the floor. Representative Garofalo, how many counties were you covering in the bill originally? He said a couple dozen more. We got 87.
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, the intent of the language was to prioritize resources of those counties that have higher unemployment rates than those that, that are currently receiving the assistance. So my recollection is that it impacts 27 counties, but I may be wrong about that. Should the committee adopt the Knobloch language again, I don't know what that number would be.
And, Mr. Chairman, you indicated a couple dozen, so sounds like we're talking maybe close to 45 or 50 counties that would have a high enough unemployment rate then to qualify.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, the Knobloch language takes into account factors other than unemployment, so I just don't have the wage data. I'm sorry.
I think we'd like to have more information on that, if it would be all right when the bill hits the House floor, then, that would give us some idea of what's being covered and what the impact of the other criteria language is. It's obviously expanding it somehow. I think at this point in time, Mr. Chairman, I'd urge a no vote. Without more information about what's being covered.
Okay. Any other discussion? Mm-hmm. Seeing none, all in favor of the A13 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
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 The motion prevails, the A13 amendment is adopted. Okay, next I'd like to take up the A15 amendment. Representative Anderson moves the A15 amendment. Or was that? Were you going to take that, Representative Garofalo? Representative Garofalo moves the A15 amendment.
And Mr. Chairman and members, this is Representative Nash's language that was in the bill. When we inserted it in the bill, we accidentally put in the original version as opposed to the language that was amended in committee. So this conforms the language to the committee process.
Okay. Discussion to the A15 amendment. See no discussion. All in favor of the A15 amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The A15 amendment is adopted. Okay, next we have Representative Baker moves the A10 amendment. Representative Baker to the A10 amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, we have a provision in here that was actually carried by Chair Knobloch through the committee, and we just wanted to spread out the geographic location where some of these funds can be used for some help with some diversity assistance with either job startups. Maybe the author could talk a little bit more about the specifics of it, but I'm just grateful that we're able to open up some of the geographic locations for West Central Minnesota versus the St. Cloud area, as the amendment states, so that we can help some more people.
Yeah. And members, the language which is on page 68. Members may remember that last year we had a fair amount of equity or money in the jobs bill meant to deal with racial disparities and economic disparities. And actually, when all was said and done, virtually none of that money went to greater Minnesota. It all stayed in the metro area. There was a little bit of it went down to southern Minnesota, but none of it went to any populations of minorities north of the metro area. And so I was approached by people about, since there was going to be some additional equity money in the bills this year, having some money that was more specifically targeted towards greater Minnesota. There's an organization called the Central Minnesota Community Foundation that covers and has offices in St. Cloud, Alexandria, Brainerd, and Wilmer, and I felt that they would be a good grant writing or grant administering agency for these funds, and this just makes it a little bit more specific. that we are covering that wider area than just strictly the St. Cloud area. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then does this amendment cover the same population that the previous grants were targeting, or is this a different population as well?
It covers the same populations. And I support and speak for the Baker 810 amendment. Any discussion on the 810 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the 810 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The 810 amendment is adopted. And then Representative Hillstrom, I think you've got an amendment. Am I right, the A2 amendment?
I do, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yes, please. Representative Hillstrom moves the A2 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, this amendment was brought to me by bus drivers. Currently, food workers, food service workers at schools are eligible for unemployment. However, bus drivers are not in the summer. And there is a bus driver shortage, and it's my understanding that both bus drivers and bus companies, are interested in finding ways that they can better have employees stay and not have quite such a turnover. So, Mr. Chair, this would simply add the bus drivers as well and make them eligible for unemployment.
Okay. Discussion to the A2 amendment. Representative Garofalo, can I call on you for your position on the Hillstrom A2 amendment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. The unemployment provisions that are contained in this bill conform to the recommendations of the Unemployment Insurance Task Force. We've made no deviations from it, so I've respectfully requested no vote on that. Again, in this bill, we just want to make sure that we're following those recommendations right now.
Okay. Other discussions to the A2 amendment? See no discussion. All in favor of the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
The motion does not prevail. The A2 amendment is not adopted. Representative Baker, I think you've got the next amendment, but I'm not sure which number it is.
Seven.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the A7 amendment.
Representative Baker moves the A7 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I think I'll have Chief Arthur Garofalo just kind of give the overview of the biomass situation, and then I can kind of follow up with the A7 and what it intends to do.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Sections 41 and Section 42 of the bill on page 192 are some changes we made to the biomass mandate program. We got rid of them, and then we allowed flexibility for the public utility in question to negotiate with the energy producers to suspend or modify the power purchase agreement in the intent of reaching a more sustainable solution. Representative Baker is moving, and I support the adoption of this amendment to delete those sections from the bill, as well as on page 194, line 21, where you see the sections there, it deletes that number from there, from the repealer language of the biomass repeal. So that's what it does. It gets the biomass out.
Okay. Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, members, this came as a sort of a late addition or hearing in the Jobs and Energy Committee that I sit on. This is a big factor for a plant that currently burns biomass turkey litter in Benson, Minnesota, which is right next to my district in west central Minnesota. There's a lot of issues with the biomass questions. There's a lot of understanding that these power purchase agreements are very costly to Xcel Energy customers right now, and we think that we have some more work to do on this. Because it came so late to us, this amendment is just asking for us to kind of take a minute and pause and to try to talk to our stakeholders back home in Benson. We have a lot of truckers right now that are hauling wood chips into the Benson plant and turkey litter from local turkey farms. And we've got a community right now that's sort of getting their a plan for what the future might hold for this plant. This was convened to, I think, the state legislature back in the 1990s or so, I think, Chair Garofalo, if I'm right, with the nuclear cask discussions, I think, back with the Prairie Island nuclear storage. So what we've learned in the meantime is that biomass is not a very cheap way to make power, and this is very expensive. But what we need to do is to make sure that we take this out. Let's give our community some time to kind of come up with a better plan. And at this time, we're just asking it to be set aside, have some more time for the community and stakeholders to come together. I've been visiting with them all day today, and I feel very confident that we will find some good resolutions to this. But right now, we want to make a statement to the community that we're hearing this, and they're very nervous and scared. There's a lot of jobs on the line right now, and a lot of folks that are making some very big investments. So for the wood haulers, for the turkey litter haulers and the workers, we want to make sure that we take a good hard look at this and see what's right for the community. So with that, Mr. Chair, members, I would ask your support for this.
Okay, Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, that was 1994, and there's two of us on the committee here that were on the conference committee at the time. And so I've got just a basic question, because what that legislation did at the time, it said 450 megawatts of wind energy, 50 megawatts of biomass. And so are we, that was a very delicate, as I spoke to on the House floor, relative to the $500,000 per cask per year for storage. Does this undo any of the agreement that was made in 1994 then with this amendment? Because you say you're trying to get some breathing room.
Melanie, recognize the chair, Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, the adoption of this amendment will return us to current law.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So members may have seen on the floor, I sent out to everybody a letter that I had received. I assumed that the person probably sent it to a lot of you. And it had to do with, I think it was about this issue. It was a gentleman from Brainerd who had a business and was really worried that his business was going to be pushed into bankruptcy by something concerning biomass, I believe. And he was telling us that if this wasn't removed from the bill, that a bunch of loggers were going to be driving to the Capitol with their logging trucks. I sent it out to all of you because I thought maybe they would be in violation of the law that you were just then passing. And but anyway, I was wondering, is this amendment going to take care of the problem that that gentleman had and keep them from coming here and blocking the roads with their logging trucks?
Representative Garofalo, you want to take that one?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, two things. Number one, I believe it's going to address their concerns, but more importantly, it's going to make it really fun when those stakeholders come back to me later this session and ask me to put these sections back into the bill.
Other discussion to the amendment? We did not have anyone request to give testimony on this. I know this is a important issue that has received a lot of debate lately. But if there's no other discussion, I will call the question on the A7 amendment. All in favor of the A7 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The A7 amendment is adopted. Okay, members, I'm unaware of any other amendments, but are there other amendments? Okay, seeing no other amendments, discussion to the bill. Discussion to the bill, Representative Hillsborough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I want you all to know that there's a provision in this bill which I am always speaking in opposition to. The voice over internet protocol, I believe, is in this bill. This is the provision that undoes the mandate that you have to have landlines available. This actually harms folks that live in greater Minnesota. It means that they no longer will have to comply with 100 years of consumer protections for universal service with your phone lines. And the notice for termination. And so this absolutely has a whole bunch of other pieces that are anti-consumer, but that one in particular I always oppose, Mr. Chair. I would encourage members to vote no.
Other discussion? Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I wonder if Representative Garofalo will comment on the broadband number. There's 7 million in the bill. The governor, I think, requested 60. There's a task force that said we need about 100. this was an issue before the transition, before you became chair, that I was quite heavily involved in, and it's a big issue in greater Minnesota. So I'd like to know a little bit more about why the $7 million, which is way below both the governor's number and the task force, and I think lower than anything we've done in recent years relative to broadband. When I last fall was out in greater Minnesota, various events, broadband often came up. You know, if I was at an event for, well, quite frankly, one of our candidates or something out there in greater Minnesota, activists in the community that might have been there were wanting to know what was going to happen with broadband. So,
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Carlson, you are correct. This is a reduced amount of spending in this area. And the reason why is that as of 2 weeks ago, there is no longer any unserved territory in the state of Minnesota for broadband. In December of last year, HughesNet launched a new satellite internet service that, again, 2 weeks ago just went production, just went live. So right now, any Minnesotan anywhere in the state has access to 25 meg download and 3 meg upload for their internet service. And that's available to the whole state, and that is the statewide broadband goal for 2022. So I would candidly tell you the $7 million in this bill is $7 million too much, because right now meeting the statewide broadband goal in 2022, technology has come forward and met that goal for us, and every Minnesotan now has access to 25 meg download, 3 meg upload.
Mr. Chairman, that doesn't fit the concern that as recently as this past fall that I was hearing when I was out and about in greater Minnesota. So there seems to be one way or another a bit of a disconnect here, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, members, I've got Representative Hornstein, Wagenius, and Erdahl. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Well, there's a lot I oppose in this bill, but I wanted to particularly call attention to lines 29 through 31 on page 181. And this exempts pipelines from the Certificate of Need process. And, you know, we have a Certificate of Need process, you know, specifically to, you know, address whether, you know, a project serves the state's long-term energy needs. And there's a number of environmental considerations. And most importantly, it examines alternatives. And so those are important criteria, and to just throw those out like this I think is irresponsible, and you know, we need to have energy policy in the state that, you know, addresses the realities of climate change, addresses the realities of changing demand for oil products, and I just think this is unnecessary and problematic. So for many reasons I'm voting no, but I wanted to call attention specifically to this pipeline provision, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wagenius, was it you that raised your hand, or maybe I was thinking Representative Hausman? You. Okay, I did get it right. Representative Wagenius. And you. Yes, I saw you again later. Okay, Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you. Just on the following up on Representative Hornstein on the energy provisions in this bill. 2 years ago, I was writing about this bill and said it was the worst energy bill ever. And you've matched. But one of the things I said in committee is I would try to figure out how many years we're going backwards. And I did that. It's when Ronald Reagan first came into office and he got rid of all the research on renewable energy and took the solar panels off the roof of the White House. So that was 1986, and I think this is about where this bill is. We'll have the discussions about energy on the floor.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And my interest was piqued by the comment that we don't have any unserved or underserved areas anymore. Since I'm one that has 0.5 megabytes, except now I can go 40 feet in the air and nail a dish to my tree and get up to 7, are you telling me that there's now a better option for me?
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl, that is correct. About 2 weeks ago, a satellite they launched in December is now in production. Anyone in the 48 continental United States has access to 25 meg download and 3 meg upload. There is no unserved territory in Minnesota. The underserved definition of 25.3 still exists, but there's no unserved territory no longer in the state of Minnesota as of about 2 weeks ago.
Representative Erdahl.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Garofalo, that's very good news for the whole state. And now this satellite, is that what it's transmitted?
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl, yes, geosynchronous orbit.
Thank you very much.
Representative Houseman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to just make a comment about two things. And I think I was scrambling a bit when you had the A5 because I saw that among other things that it did, it reduces state spending for job creation fund. And maybe we've helped a little bit. The deed letter tells us that the severe restrictions on where a deed can award job creation that would eliminate deed's ability to invest in impactful projects in ineligible communities which benefit neighboring counties and often have a regional significance. It's hard to target, and when we appropriate dollars, we don't always know what opportunities will be there and a certain amount of freedom. But I think we helped that a little bit with the Knobloch Amendment. Is that correct? The restrictions to the BIT?
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chair, Representative Houseman, help would be an opinion as opposed to a fact. I think the original bill, the focus was on focusing these resources that have the highest unemployment rates. And with the adoption of the committee adopting the Knobloch Amendment, we do a little bit less of that.
And I think, Mr. Chair, what they point out is even when you target neighboring counties, regional areas, often there's a spillover effect in that, and so restricting them. And the other is an issue that two organizations that I have great respect for bring to us. The Minnesota Housing Partnership points out a couple of things about housing, and they point out to us, we know that the entire community gains when sensible, effective investments in housing benefit employers, workers, and lower-income Minnesotans. And then they have two significant issues that compromise important housing development throughout the state. One is that we apparently underfund the Challenge Program, which is MHFA's most flexible gap financing tool available to developers and that is affordable to the local workforce, and that funds leverage those state funds leverage substantial non-state resources to produce housing that meets local needs. So it looks like that's one of their issues. Their other issue, again, also talks about restrictive language. Local communities need maximum flexibility in assembling a range of financing tools to ensure projects will be successful. And combining different financing sources is particularly true for housing that is intended to further a variety of community objectives. So it looks as though they point out two challenges there. That's also reiterated, I think, in the MHFA letter, and they point out the huge impact that program has. In 2016, nearly 600 units of housing were financed with the Challenge Program statewide. In the last 2 years, nearly 90% of Challenge funds for rental were used in Greater Minnesota to address workforce housing needs. And again, they say it's one of their most flexible programs designed to meet a wide range of housing needs identified by local communities. So it's that part is a disappointment. We see from a number of organizations that have experience with this that it does have impacts that we'll feel for some time.
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Houseman, so what we did in this bill is we took the existing workforce housing funding and we moved it from deed to MHFA. We put that on top of the Challenge Grant Program for the first year, the first fiscal year of this biennium. However, there have been problems previously with administering this program and actually jump-starting the workforce housing market in certain communities. So what we are doing is we are withholding the Challenge Grant appropriation in the second year of the biennium to ensure that the workforce housing funds are appropriated in the manner that the legislature intends. That's something that we should be able to easily see. And next year, in the event that they follow through on their commitment to fund the program as the legislature intends. I look forward to fully funding the Challenge Grant Program in the second year of the biennium. That's a matter of trust, but verify.
Representative,
Mr. Chairman, Representative, trust, but verify.
No, but trusting who?
MHFA.
Wow. It's a pretty trustworthy organization. I'm surprised to hear that. And their letter is dated April 3, so obviously they're reflecting on what they see in the bill.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, I'm happy to speak with you and the commissioner offline about it. But the reality is we haven't seen solutions being implemented in the workforce housing arena in certain regional centers. And the entire purpose of the workforce housing initiative is to break through to these markets to develop an appropriate pricing mechanism for actual private sector financing. We have the jobs, we have the incomes, but the markets are broken. Previous programs we've implemented just haven't worked. We think this is the way to resolve those issues and for everyone to win.
Other discussion to Senate File 1937 as amended. Representative Garofalo, do you have any final comments on your bill?
Just look forward to working with each of the commissioners and ask for members' support.
Okay, seeing no further discussion, Representative Garofalo renews his motion that Senate File 1937, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No. Motion prevails. Senate File 1937, as amended, is referred to the General Register. Okay, next up will be the State Government Finance Bill.
Sarah, don't take it personally. Don't take it personally.
Right. Yep, we'll take care of that. Okay, Representative Anderson moves that Senate File 605 be referred to the General Register, and Representative Anderson moves that the House File language for House File 691 be substituted in place of the Senate File language. Is there any discussion to that procedural motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The House language is substituted for the Senate language. Representative Anderson, do you want to take amendments first, or do you want to present the bill?
I'll just briefly present the bill, and then we can go straight to amendments, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Anderson.
Members, the target for the State Government Finance Bill is $943,342,000. We have prioritized veterans in this bill by extending the GI benefits. That is part of the governor's recommendations. We also allow for free and discounted burials for veteran spouses in state veteran cemeteries. And we also supply funding for the Journey Home, which provides grants for affordable veteran housing and education on training on veteran criminal justice issues. That's part of the Veteran Defense Project. Yes. On part of this, we also have some transparency and accountability measures and reform measures as well. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to go to amendments.
Okay, which amendment would you like first, Representative Anderson?
I think we'll take up the A3 amendment first, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Anderson moves the A3 amendment. The A3 amendment, Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, the A3 amendment is just a technical amendment that addresses some of the outstanding issues and making sure that we are covering some things. The first one on line 1.4 is dealing with the filing issue, if I've got it correctly. The second one on page 69 is dealing with the pipeline, and the third one, again, is on the filing piece. And then, of course, on line 13, it's dealing with the Washington, D.C. office. And so that's all the amendment does, is just gets the bill in the order in which we wish to have it.
Okay, discussion to the A3 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none. All in favor of the A3 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The A3 amendment is adopted. Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, there's the A2 amendment. I believe Representative Murphy plans to move that one.
Representative Murphy, is that your amendment?
It is, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is actually an amendment that Representative Mahoney has been working on, and I'm offering it tonight, and it is authorization for the Ice Palace to be put on the Capitol grounds and what we will do with the grounds once the Ice Castle is gone. And I understand that is supported by all the various parties, and there's someone here to testify.
All right. Representative Murphy moves the A2 amendment, and is there someone here to testify? Yes, sir. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jeremy Estenson. I work for the law firm of Stinson Leonard Street, and we're here before you representing the St. Paul Festival and Heritage Foundation, who has, since 1886, put on the St. Paul Winter Carnival. And they did so in a response to a newspaper article a number of businessmen didn't like, comparing Minnesota to the Siberian wasteland. So they decided they'd put a big party on in the wintertime. They've been doing it ever since. 36 times they've built a large ice castle. This will be the 37th. Their hope is to build one even a little bit taller than the 1992 world record-setting castle in on Harriet Park at 166 feet. We're here before you today because there were arrangements made, the Heritage Foundation had made arrangements with an alternate site. Unfortunately, that site, after doing the numbers, found out that it would be pushing $1 million to restore the grounds to their former condition. And that was a budget breaker for the Heritage Foundation. So, not even 30 days ago, they reached out to us and the Department of Administration and said, might we be able to locate this thing on the South Capitol lawn? The department said, I think so. We've done this sort of thing in the past with Taste of Minnesota, the Marathon, and other things. So having worked with the department, worked with the City of St. Paul and others, it's our intention to continue ironing things out, but we understand that the language before you resolves most of their concerns.
Discussion to the A2 Amendment. Representative Murphy, any last comments on the amendment?
I would love your support.
Recommend the support of the A2 amendment. All in favor of the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The A2 amendment is adopted. Are there any other amendments? Seeing no other amendments, this discussion to the bill. And I know we have some people that want to testify. Maybe I should call forward Commissioner France. Are you ready, sir? Well, Commissioner France, welcome back to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, members, and Madam Chair, thank you. It's been a while. It's good to be back. Thank you. I just wanted to, for the record, make some comments on behalf of the Governor regarding House File 691. And I just wanted to let you know that in testifying that I'm here to speak on behalf of MMB, the Department of Administration, the Department of Revenue, and Minnesota IT Services. In the interest of brevity and previous testimony that the commissioners have provided, and most of them are here to provide any answers to questions you may have. But I just wanted to start off by talking about my concerns about House File 691. And first of all, I want to say that I'm disappointed. This bill, in our opinion, is not a good faith attempt to work at a settlement with the governor to pass a budget by May 22nd. The governor and we believe that this House File 691 arbitrarily cuts budget operations from anywhere from 4% to 23% for MMB. The governor has been absolutely clear. He does not support arbitrary, undisciplined slashing of agency budgets. We all understand that the leadership in the Minnesota House of Representatives has a different view of the role of government in the lives of Minnesotans. And we also understand the process of negotiating a state budget and clarifying priorities from both sides in order to find compromise. But we believe this bill is not a serious attempt to find compromise, but rather is a strategic budget, and we are concerned this is an adversarial budget. Cutting agencies by roughly 25% is simply not work. 25% is simply not workable, especially when we have worked diligently on our financial management for the last 6 years, and we now have a budget surplus, and actually have had budget surpluses for 4 years in a row. And also when we have increasing costs, increasing inflation, and increasing demand for state services. I want to be perfectly clear, House File 691, if not amended, to provide sufficient funding for the services of Minnesotans in a fiscally responsible way that required me to recommend to Governor Dayton that he veto the bill. But I'm here to speak just briefly on the governor's priorities in the state budget. He has made his budget priorities really clear, I think, to the people of Minnesota and to the legislature. As I'm sure you're aware, he's provided a letter to the legislative leaders to articulate the priorities that he has for passing a budget on May 22, and he stated quite clearly that he would not accept across-the-board agency cuts, and he also wants to specifically require the committee or the legislature to specifically state what kind of services the legislature thinks that the agencies do not need to provide anymore. He also has concerns about policy bills or policy provisions that are contained within budget bills and would request that those policy bills be standalone bills to be considered on their own merits. So I could speak to this committee at length about the imprudent cuts in this bill. I could talk about accounting shifts and the rating of previously appropriated funds in order to claim savings, but I could also talk about the legislative micromanaging that takes away the state's ability to work efficiently. I could talk about cuts to the Department of Revenue that will create significant delays in processing tax returns and will actually cost the state $37 million in lost revenue. I could talk about the elimination of several programs in the Department of Administration that actually make state government costs more cost-effective and accountable. I could talk about how the failure to fund the governor's cybersecurity proposal in Minute will continue to put thousands of Minnesotans' personal data at risk. But I and many others have already testified about these issues in earlier hearings. I could also speak once again about the governor's transparent, fiscally responsible approach to the budget, about the investment he makes to build a more competitive workforce to ensure efficient and accountable outcomes in state programs, to secure our IT infrastructure, and to ensure our state government is providing the high quality services that Minnesotans deserve. But at this point, it does not seem that the committee is willing to consider those views. Members, as you've considered this budget bill this week, there have been lofty claims of savings and so-called ballooning of the cost of government. House File 691 is an example where several of these claims have been made. I want to reference a few real numbers to clearly state the facts. House File 691 cuts 23% of MMB's budget under the pretext of taking the agency back to its 2011 funding level. As Commissioner of MMB, let me state the facts. MMB's base funding in 2011 was $20.2 million. The base funding in fiscal 2016 was $22.5 million. The 6 years of growth totals 10.7%. This represents an annualized growth of 2.3%. The 2.3 annualized growth for 6 years is consistent with increased demand for services, increased costs, and inflation over the same time period. These numbers are the facts. I will tell you that MMB runs a lean organization and one that provides essential services to all of state government, including this body. I encourage members of this committee to be vigilant over claims about savings and support budget bills that are based upon facts. The facts in this case are real, and please make sure that the claims for savings are real, too. In our view, House File 691 is not a responsible, transparent way to budget. It is designed to meet an arbitrary budget target and does so through arbitrary cuts and accounting shifts. There are only 7 weeks left in the legislative session, and I ask this committee to pass a serious budget so we can work on behalf of the Minnesota and finish this session on time on May 22nd. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Any discussion or questions for Commissioner France? Representative Hussman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Franz, so as I went through the bill and then heard you reflect, what I thought about were some of the reports you and the governor's office have given us over this past year in study after study and report after report across the country that this state comes in ranked often and somehow in the top five in a whole range of areas of well-managed states and so it feels a little like to me you're now being punished for your good work. We're going to drastically cut you, the employees and the departments, but by the way, you get new responsibility.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think one of the things that we've talked about before in this committee and other committees is the great job that Minnesota does, the great recognition that Minnesota receives as a state that works, where things get done, where government is efficient and effective. You know, one of the things that, you know, we were ranked number three by U.S. News and World Report just about a month ago, and they had a lot of different variables in that, looked at access to health care, education, infrastructure. And one of the things that we see, especially after we returned our rating to AAA rating for bond purposes, where we were able to save money when we sell bonds, one of the things that we continue to see when we go out to the rating agencies or to other agencies or to other companies that give us rankings is that we see people realize that Minnesota is one of those states that is able to maintain fiscal balance. I mean, there are a lot of states who haven't had 4 years of fiscal surpluses like we have, and they see that we're able to realize the savings and the efficient government. You know, it's the Minnesota economy that deserves the credit. The Minnesota economy is an extremely diverse economy, and it really mirrors the U.S. economy. As the U.S. economy does well, so does the Minnesota economy typically. Now, there are some sectors, the ag sector and the mining sector, that are not doing well, but overall, the Minnesota economy is doing quite well in terms of the number. Our unemployment continues to drop, and we continue to see wages grow, incomes grow. So we're quite pleased with the way we've positioned the state government to reflect the economy and the great work that Minnesota does.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could just use one example in one department that I noted, which would be revenue. So they were cut 4.3%, but then given a new responsibility, and I think there was a fiscal note for that new responsibility of $22 million, but they're not going to be given $22 million to do it. There's an expectation that even though they're cut 4.3%, that they'll absorb that $22 million.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that's the concern we have is the fact that there are additional responsibilities for virtually every agency, including MMB and Minute and Department of Administration and, as you mentioned, Department of Revenue. And to add those new responsibilities while also taking money away is a real burden on those agencies, and in particular at the Department of Revenue, and Commissioner Bauer can certainly talk to this if you wish tonight, those kinds of cuts can really lead to revenue loss eventually.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I had some of the same concerns, and I see, the Representative Hausman referenced the $22 million for the electronic filing. At the same time, there's a 4.3% cut for revenue, but I want to go up and take a look then at Minnesota management and budget. I mean, you're the commissioner, and there's a 22.7% reduction here. And do you have in management and budget additional responsibilities either in this bill or other bills that are coming through in light of that double-digit cut?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do have some added reporting responsibilities and some added responsibilities. In order to meet a cut target of 22.7%, we'd have to contemplate eliminating such things as the economic unit that does the forecasting, some of our accounting services, a large part of our budget operations that produce the budget for the state of Minnesota and for the legislature. So we have to try to figure out how to manage the cuts in those areas at the same time adding these new reporting requirements that come on at the same time. So yes, we get some new additional requirements, and we also at the same time get cuts to the agency.
Representative Carlson.
Being that we did have the commissioner here, when I looked, I've got a list here of the percentages. I don't think the author, at least yet, went through those percentage cuts. But, I've been arguing throughout the session, other bills coming through, the two tonight, that we should use a more balanced approach to the state budget than what we are. And I think we're heading, at least at this point, toward a collision between the governor's office, which did have a balanced approach to the state budget, and what these bills are doing. But when we look at the constitutional offices, in addition to key agencies, arguably they're all key agencies, but management and budget, Mr. Chairman, when he referenced the forecasting, you and I sit in on those meetings, and they're vitally important as we move forward and try to set the state budget. Just to point to just one that with that kind of a cut that could conceivably be on the chopping block if this were to become law. I think we'd probably be the only state in the union that wouldn't be doing appropriate forecasting for our state budgets if this were to happen. I'm not positive of that, but I think I have heard where every state in the union does their own forecasting. They probably have slightly different systems, but they do rely on national data that's provided and then use the state numbers as they would apply in our laws relative to revenue and expenditure. But I am quite concerned about these cuts. And just to point out one more, and I don't know if Commissioner Franz would have any comments about this one, but maybe the author could. If I see Department of Human Rights, 23.8% cut, and you know, we had a long history of case backlogs, and I don't know if that's something you'd be knowledgeable about, Commissioner, or not, but if we're still dealing with the backlog of cases and we're sustaining that kind of a budget cut, it could create some real problems in that state agency for what they're directed to do.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do think it's a problem. Commissioner Lindsay is certainly here. He can testify to that directly if you'd like. But you're right, it is a concern.
I could go further, but I'll stop, Mr. Chairman. I'm quite concerned about this overall budget approach to our state government and state agencies.
I don't see any other questions. Oh, sorry, Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I guess a comment more than anything. In the bill, Representative Anderson, that's essentially the Health Insurance Transparency Act again, something that we passed in 2014 by bipartisan support, something that is saving school employees, property taxpayers money all across the state of Minnesota. And I see one more time for the third year in a row, you're attempting to strip that out or neuter it, if you will. And I just want to put it on the record that I don't understand why. And I'll see what we can do about it on the floor. Also want to just call attention to the ethnic councils. I understand that the funding for that is flat, but there may be some obligation that they have to pay for some of the services they don't have to pay for right now. They're small. They're small agencies doing very important work for the state of Minnesota, and I'm worried about their viability under this proposal. I want to call that out for you as well. There's, you know, significant hits to the administration, to the auditor's office, to the attorney general's office. I'm concerned about that. The secretary of state's office, of course, very important functions there. I know you want to save taxpayer dollars, but I think this goes too far. So just wanted to put that on the record for you. Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is more of a question about how this would actually work. So the way I understand the bill is that, Representative Anderson, is that you're basically doing a 2,000 employee or FTE equivalent maximum number, less than what we have in state employees now. And it's my understanding that it's going to be managed kind of by MMB to make certain that we hit that number. And I believe, from the way I read the bill, that the legislature would be included as well. So in the event MMB hires too many people or based on snowplow drivers' needs or park needs, are they going to have the ability to determine how many employees we get to hire here, or are we going to get to determine how many people they hire there if we overhire? Or how is that actually going to function?
Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom. That applies only to the executive branch, and if you look at the numbers on the executive branch, it's roughly a little over 32,000 individuals, and what we're asking for is a number of, 31,941, so you're looking at approximately 786 FTEs,
and we ask that the MMA commissioner use what they've used in the past on this and offering early retirement incentives for individuals and other means of attrition. So that's what it does. Doesn't impact the legislature and certainly is the right direction for us to take, because what we're looking at with that number is we are asking agencies to go back between what we had in calendar year 2013 and 2014. That's how much we've grown in FTEs since between 2013 and 2014. And we're just asking them to go back 3 years, essentially, 3.5 years, to the numbers that we had in FTEs. But within that 3-year time period, that is how much government has grown.
Mr. Chair. Representative Hillsborough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we just passed the public safety bill, and we funded the Department of Corrections, the BCA, law enforcement type folks in that bill. So does your bill then kind of supersede Representative Cornish's bill and determine someone else now gets to determine how many corrections officers Representative Cornish's bill is actually going to pay for? I'm trying to figure out how this is going to actually work in practicality, because ultimately we determined how many FTEs we thought we needed in public safety, and we paid for them today. And I want to know what your bill is going to do to his bill.
Chair Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, this is no different than what we've done in the past. And what we are asking is, we're saying government has grown since 2013 by 786 FTEs just within a 3-year period. And we're saying we need to slow the growth, we need to get some management around this, and we need to prioritize. Yes, that's what we're looking to do. I don't think anybody, when they saw the surplus, said we should spend it on more state government. I think most Minnesotans would say that focus should be on tax relief, that should be on our education bill, that should be on transportation, that should be on public safety. Nobody was clamoring to say that we need to grow government.
Mr. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Anderson, we also heard testimony from the tax court that you have language in your bill that would have ultimately made it so that if it wasn't specifically funded in Representative Cornish's bill, that when you ask an agency or a department to absorb the cost, that you actually have language in your bill that would prohibit them from taking any staff savings and fund it on things that we're asking them to absorb, but that they would actually have to spend their staff money only on the staff as allowed in the bill. Is that still in your bill?
Chair Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, it only applies to the executive branch and doesn't apply to the judiciary.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it would apply to the Department of Corrections, the BCA, the State Patrol, and other law enforcement agencies that come out of the administration. Is that correct?
Chair Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, can you show me the line in the bill that you're looking at specifically?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually don't have it open to that particular page. We just were specifically told about it by the tax court. When it came to their concern about funding their case management system. So that's why I'm asking you if it's still in the bill and where you might help me find that.
Chair Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, as I told you, it doesn't apply to the judiciary. But if you can tell me the area that you're referring to in the other part of your question, I'm happy to help you out.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll get to that in a moment. I'll ask you another question if that is fine. So my last question then becomes about the cybersecurity piece that's not being funded in this bill. The legislature has put in law that if someone improperly accesses data that's supposed to be private or supposed to be a secret, or the state does something that causes that data to be available to someone else, that the state is liable, and up to, I believe it's $1,000 per incident. So if the legislature doesn't fund cybersecurity and folks have the ability to hack it and get access to it, who's actually liable for those costs if people's information gets out there and they find out that it actually came from the state?
Chair Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, you're going to have to repeat that because I was looking for the answer to your question. If you look at page 48, starting on lines 3 through 5, you will see that reductions in staff would protect the health care workers, correction officers, public safety workers, and mental health workers.
Okay, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this will be the last line of questioning that I take, but the governor has recommended some cybersecurity costs. As we've seen, there have been hacking of our government, sometimes political parties and others, in which people get access to data that they should not. The state of Minnesota holds a lot of data about people, tax returns, whether or not you apply for some government services, W-2 information from all of our employees, and we have in law that if someone illegally accesses that data, that there's liability. And I believe it's $1,000 per time that it's breached, per person, per incident. I actually had someone improperly look up my data, and so that gave me the right to say to the government, you are liable to me for that cost. I didn't, but I would have had the ability to do that. So my question is, if we fail to fund cybersecurity to keep people from stealing Minnesotans' data, who's liable when that data gets out in the public and somebody gets your Social Security number, your driver's license number, your address, what your income is, anything about you? Who's liable for that breach in the data system?
Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom. If you see a note in the bill that we ask Minute to prioritize cybersecurity and make that one of their priorities in their operations, Minute has in previous years received funding to the tune of $8.5 million for the purpose of charging back to the agencies to make sure that cybersecurity is happening. They haven't done that. And so they have the mechanism in place. They've been given money in the past to do it, and they haven't done it. So we have, as a legislature, told them to do this. Much like the gain-sharing program for MMB, they have failed to do that programming. And so, you know, there's only so much we can do at the legislature when we direct agencies to do that, and they fail to do it.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and then this will just be the final comment. But Representative Anderson, I understand that you may be frustrated that that has not been done, but I'm frustrated that we continue to order agencies to do things and we don't pay for what it is that we ask them to do, and then we're surprised when they don't have the money to do it. So the legislature has an obligation to prioritize as well. And I saw we just adopted another amendment which asked an agency to absorb $22 million. If it's important enough to you, you would find a way to fund it. I have nothing else, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Does anyone have any other questions for Commissioner Franz? Because I do have one other or testifier, group of testifiers. Representative Carlson?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I don't know if this should be to Commissioner Franz or not, or the author, but I see with PERA, the base spending was $32 million, and it's the committee recommendations are going to be $12 million. That's a 62.5% reduction from base. I know, Commissioner Franz, you had built in funding for the pension plans, TRA and the K-12 finance bill, PERA here, MSRS, I guess, in this bill. And the concern I have not only is that reduction, but the comment a few moments ago by the author that when we were talking about the 786 reduction in FTEs, that one of the solutions might be early retirement. And I've dealt several years ago with early retirement incentives, and there are costs. There's costs in a variety of ways, but one of the costs is to the state pension plans. When people retire earlier. So I don't know if you have any comments there or if the chair of the committee has any comments about if they looked at what the potential costs of early retirement might be. And then the other question for either of you would be, that 786, if that's an accurate number. I've heard 2,000. But if some of those would be layoffs, and when you begin to lay off state employees, and this would be true of local units of government and so on, there are costs when you lay off somebody. They're entitled to severance pay. There are other cost issues related to layoffs, and I don't know if any of those kinds of things are covered or built into this bill or not. So if one or the two of you could answer those questions.
Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson. The MRF pension plan is closed, so this would have no impact on that at all.
I referenced PERA and MSRS. I didn't reference MRF.
Okay. Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think one of the things that one of the reasons we tried to build in an operating adjustment, you'll see an operating adjustment for most of the agencies in this bill and other bills, and that's where we added in the pension reform that the governor recommended. So as you know, the Legislative Pension Commission is working on that. I've testified there. We've presented information there. The goal is to, the governor has proposed spending $100 million in this next biennium to shore up the pension proposal by increasing the contributions by the agency as the employer, and as you mentioned in the teacher, in the formula, a specific pension aid in the formula for schools so that they can pay the teachers that portion. But we also required that the employees increase their contribution level too, and also asked that the COLAs be, automatic COLAs be adjusted in the future. So the pension reform that you're referring to, that it was contained in this bill and other bills, was designed to be an agency by agency contribution for the potential pension costs for that agency. And so that is an important part of the governor's recommendation. It's not contained, and obviously the cuts to the agencies wouldn't fund the pension portion of the governor's proposal for pension reform.
And Representative Carlson, if I can interrupt with two things. First of all, the other testifiers that wanted to testify tonight were with some of the pension plans, so we'll have them up in a moment.
Because my question had kind of two parts of it to the commissioner and the author. One was the reform that was built in, but the other part of it was that it appears to me we're adding a new responsibility in a sense with the early retirement provision, which could conceivably have, as I remember a few years ago, that had a cost on the plan. So on the one hand, when we're trying to solve an unfunded liability, we're perhaps increasing the costs on the plans with the early retirements that are built into the expectation with that 786 people, that some of them, I have no idea from that earlier testimony, might opt for early retirement, but that would be potentially an additional cost. But if the pension people are coming out, maybe they can address some of those. So thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
And if the pension folks that are asked to testify, Leon Stagg, Aaron Leonard, and Lori Hacking could come forward. And while they're coming forward, Representative Carlson, let me say, kind of with Chair Anderson's bill and all the bills, I think we took a position on the House Republican Caucus that it was premature to put specific dollar amounts for pensions in these bills absent any sort of negotiated agreement between the state and the plans on what the final agreement should be. I think there's an expectation that there's going to have to be additional money put in for pensions, but without having an actual agreement, we just thought it was premature to be putting in specific numbers. And so once there is some sort of agreement presumably reached with the Pension Commission, we anticipate that there is going to be some additional money that needs to be come up with.
So, Mr. Chairman, you have money on the bottom line to resolve that if it's needed?
Well, we're going to first see, Representative Carlson, what the proposals are that they come up with. And we do have, I think last count I saw was $300-some million in the tails, which is where a significant amount of that money would likely come from. Welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means. Could you state your names for the record and give us your testimony?
Lori Hacking, Executive Director of Teachers Retirement Association.
And I'm Erin Leonard, the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Retirement System.
And also
a representative from the State Board of Investment will be behind us. We're testifying together today because we have concerns about a provision in the bill that relates to our requirement for our systems and SBI to use minutes services. And I call your attention, it's actually on page 46 of the bill. There is existing language in current law that is being stricken, and that's really what we're going to be speaking to today. This would strike existing law that allows the retirement systems to use minutes services on a voluntary basis. If this language goes forward, we would be required to use them on a mandatory basis. This language was added in the state government finance bill at the very end of the committee's markup process, so apologize, we didn't have an opportunity to testify at that point because it was past the point at which public testimony could be taken. So we would like the stricken language reinstated. Just by way of background, like I said, currently we do use Minute on a voluntary basis when they can meet our requirements and are a cost-effective solution. Over many years, our retirement systems and the State Board have invested a lot, and we have an extensive IT infrastructure in place. We do this because we're small agencies, but we have very high transactional volumes. We are responsible for assets of over $68 billion. We make payments of $4 billion a year. That means monthly checks have to go out. We collect revenue over $2 billion annually. And we keep records for over 700,000 members, and that includes a lot of private data, not just Social Security numbers, dates of birth, but we're talking medical records. Bank account numbers. We have paid a lot of attention to cybersecurity and have very high quality threat detection software, and we do frequent penetration testing to make sure that all works. Because we've made significant investments in this IT infrastructure and have long-standing contracts for services, there would be very, very significant transition costs if this language went through. As I want to emphasize, we do use Minute when we can and when it's cost effective. And Ms. Leonard is going to address specifically the cost effectiveness.
Ms. Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. MSRS has many concerns regarding the consolidation of our IT infrastructure with Minute. As fiduciaries, our board has taken several steps to find ways to reduce IT costs while improving security for our systems. We recently changed our hosting provider from Minute to a third party in 2016. This change is estimated to save about $1.1 million per year going forward, which is about 6% of our annual administrative budget. So it is significant savings. In addition, as a result of this change, we've been able to achieve redundancy for multiple environments in our pension administration system, a disaster recovery site, including failover tests, enhanced security of private data or personally identifiable information of our members at a lower cost. This redundancy allows our pension administration system and participant website to be considered highly available in IT terms, resulting in more reliable service for our members. In addition, the contract with the hosting provider includes service level agreements with financial penalties for non-performance. All the items that I described above, high availability, enhanced security around PII, disaster recovery testing, and service level agreements, weren't included in our prior hosting arrangement with Minute. MSRS is a smaller agency when compared to other state agencies, but has significant financial obligations that must be paid each month to benefit recipients and contributions that must be collected from multiple employers throughout the state. Minute is responsible for IT services for all executive branch agencies. Most are much larger in size than MSRS, which results in MSRS being lower priority, and Minute was only able to provide best effort SLAs for MSRS. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Good
Good evening, Chair and committee members. My name is Leanne Stagg. I'm the Assistant Executive Director and Chief Operating Officer at the State Board of Investment, sitting in for Mr. Perry, who was not able to be here tonight. So, as you've heard, the SBI invests pension, state operating, cash assets, and other trust fund assets, which at the end of 2016 was valued at just over $80 billion. So whenever the SBI can, we have used Minute Services. We use their email system because it met our requirements and we found it to be cost effective. However, the SBI has established and maintained our own infrastructure system to ensure the payment of critical, time-sensitive, and very large payments. So if you take a look at the pension payments that was mentioned earlier, we invest all of the assets, obviously, but every month, at the first day of the first business day of the month, we have to make sure that we have $350 million in cash available to make those pension payments. If there were a problem with the software that we use to make that cash available, we would need to take immediate corrective action, have somebody right there to correct it, so that some 200,000 pensioners would receive their pension checks on time. Similarly, the SBI invests $10 billion of the state's agency operating assets that they don't need immediately for their operations. Again, if we did have a problem with software that transfers some of the assets, if you're making $350 million to $550 million on average a day of trades, you can see that we potentially could be missing some very large opportunities on the investment side and potentially face some fines with failed trades as well. So just to give you an idea, even missing out on a few tenths of a percentage point on investment income translates into real money when you're talking about a portfolio of $10 billion. So, for example, missing out on investment opportunities of just 0.3% over a year would translate into $30 million in lost investment income for the portfolio. So again, because of the critical nature of these and time-sensitive nature of very large payments that we're responsible for, the SBI has determined it's appropriate, most appropriate, for us to maintain our own infrastructure and to provide the immediate recovery we would need of any of those systems that transfer dollars for us. Thank you very much.
Does anyone have any questions for Ms. Hacking, Ms. Leonard, or Ms. Stagg? All right, thank you very much. Representative Carlson.
Sure, I'd like to go back to the PERA thing and the the chair referenced MRF, but MRF, in my view, no longer exists because we had the merger, but there was an agreement that's part of what my question probably should have been, was that there would be an appropriation at a certain level
it doesn't hit you right
as a part of an agreement from when I was on state government finance the last biennium. And it doesn't appear that the numbers that are in the bill that were meeting that agreement that was reached, I think we're back to putting $6 million in. Is that correct, Representative Anderson?
Chair Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, yes, it would be a $6 million
amount for the state. And that the number was supposed to be significantly higher than that, so we have a cost shift. So, Mr. Chairman, as I've read some in the last couple of minutes, some of the information on it, onto local units of government, not the least of which is one of the counties that some of us here in the room represent. Hennepin County would be one. Airports Commission, you know, you can go down the list of where MRF employees were. Minneapolis City of, I think many of them MRF employees worked there. But with the merger, there was state money that was supposed to come with that so that there wasn't the shift, as I understand it, on the local units of government. And that funding level, which I think is a different question than what you answered earlier, about the unfunded liability and so on with the plans.
Well, I know, Representative Carlson, that last year, or perhaps it was the year before, there was a discussion of not putting as much money into MRF each year as we had been putting in because there was a significant surplus or less liability than had been expected, and that was something that eventually all parties agreed on, to have a reduction that year. I don't think the reduction that year was as much as the actuary had said at that time that we could take. But Chair Anderson, I don't know if you can say more about this issue.
Sure, Mr. Chair, and you are correct. The actuarial study came back and said that we didn't need the amount that was originally estimated when this was first put before the legislature. And so we now are adjusting the state share because it's, you know, we have a less amount of a cost to us as a as an entity overall when it comes to this. So we're reflecting that savings for the state, and that's what's part of this bill.
And I think if I recall correctly, Chair Anderson, a lot of that was that there just was better than expected investment performance in the MRF fund, so it had accumulated more assets than had been originally predicted. Is that correct?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chair, well, it's my understanding that 2 years ago, there was a request for $16 million, and that was dropped back to $6 million, but when I referenced an agreement, there was an agreement that it was to go back up to $16 million. I think the obligation is still there. That's why the shift that I was referring to onto local units of government then would take place, because the fund has to be funded. But I don't know if there's somebody from PERA being merged or MRF. You could quickly comment about this or not. There's somebody coming forward now. Would it be all right, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
I mean, it's an important issue because we're talking about the funding of pensions, and PERA is one of our larger ones, and MRF was originally, for the benefit of the people here, a local pension fund that covered several units of government, local units of government. I referenced a couple, three, Airports Commission, Hampton County, and so on.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Can you state your name for the record and give us your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Doug Anderson, Executive Director of the Public Employees Retirement Association. And while I wasn't present during the time of the MRF merger, I am familiar with some of the data that's involved. With the MRF merger, there was an unfunded liability that was added to the parent plan. In order to accommodate or to make sure that unfunded liability was closed, there was a total contribution requirement of $37 million per year over a 15-year period, I think, through 2031. The agreement was that the state aid would be in the amount of $16 million per year for 2 years, and with $6 million per year. $16 million per year, with that changing, and then Minneapolis began the remaining amount after that. So the total commitment would be $37 million per year in order to avoid having unfunded liability to PERA.
Chair Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, but that changed with the performance amount. And so, and you can correct me, Mr. Anderson, if I'm wrong, it wasn't the original amount was higher, if I remember correctly, than the $37 million.
Yeah, Mr. Anderson, I guess I remember a report by the pension staff here that we had at the legislature on this that a couple of years ago that showed a pretty sizable surplus. But, let me go to Representative Carlson, and then I need to recognize Representative Hornstein.
I will stop at this point. I think this probably warrants further discussion, but when we talk about the performance, it's my understanding that that's performance is a five-year average. So if you look at just a relatively short period of time, that gives you one snapshot, but isn't it just a yes or no of an average when we're looking at performance over a five-year period?
Mr. Anderson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, there are changes that happen over the course of a plan. There would have been differences in investment return, but there also is potential for other changes. So whether or not I don't believe there would have been a significant difference in the liability that would have transferred from Merck that would have occurred since the time of the merger. I'm not familiar with the study that would say otherwise.
I'll stop there because it is late, Mr. Chairman. Pensions, we could spend the whole evening on, I suspect.
Representative Hornstein.
Well, thank you. Well, to this, and I see Mr. Ranieri and Mr. Rice, and I think it's a very important point that we should briefly discuss because it hasn't been raised to date on this, that this the legislature appropriated this money and then, you know, PARA's already billing it to the city. They've already budgeted for it. We're not just talking about the city of Minneapolis. It's the Park Board, the Met Council, the Metropolitan Buildings Commission, MAC, Minneapolis School District, Hennepin County, Minsky. These are all the entities that are impacted by this. And so I thought just very briefly, Mr. Chair, if we could have either Mr. Ranieri or Mr. Rice just testify briefly to the impact. Because, again, this was already budgeted. That's the problem here that we have not discussed.
And, Mr. Chair,
Chair Anderson.
I did find my numbers here. So this was prior to, in the 2015 session, the need at that time was $55 million, and the state paid $24 million, and Minneapolis paid $31 million. And under the Thiessen formula, the need was $37 million. The state paid $16 million, and Minneapolis paid $21 million. And so we modified that in our state government finance bill in 2015, with the state paying $6 million and Minneapolis paying $31 million. So Minneapolis continued to pay their same amount that they had paid all along.
Okay, Mr. Ranieri, Mr. Rice, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. My name is Gene Ranieri. I'm with the City of Minneapolis. Representative Anderson is correct. They are the numbers. However, as part of the agreement in 2015, the $6 million being paid in 15 and 16 and 17 subsequent would be $16 million paid by the employers, would be paid by the state to PERA. And the employers include more than the City of Minneapolis, as has been stated before. So the deal in 2015 was $6 million paid by the state to PERA for MRF. In 15 and 16, and in 17 and subsequent years, it would have been 16, and the local employers would be paying $31 million. Excuse me, $21
million. Mr. Rice.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brian Rice, representing the Minneapolis Park Board. So the committee could understand the magnitude of this number. It was $55 million that was required to fund the MRF plan, split $31 million by the city, $24 by the state. There was an improvement in the returns. MRF got to 80% funded, which allowed by prior legislation the ability for MRF to consolidate fully into the PERA system. At that point in time, the liability dropped by $18 million, and the question was how to allocate that $18 million. 2 years ago, because of budget exigencies, the legislature said, okay, state will take all of those savings for the first 2 years. And instead of putting in $24 million, the state put in $6 million, the city put in $31 million. Representative Thiessen worked hard and negotiated with Representative Anderson and others, and the legislature agreed for one biennium. The state would put in $6 million for 2 years, and the city and all the employers would put in $31 million. And then, starting this upcoming biennium, the state would put in $16 million, still a pretty big savings from the $24 million they had before, and the city would take a reduction from $31 million to $21 million. So over time, the state would have saved more percentage-wise than the state. So the issue was this. I represent the Park Board. We got a letter from PARA saying that here's your bill for 17 and 18, and the bill was based on the state putting in $16 million. Now Representative Anderson's bill takes that $10 million away, and the Park Board, the School Board, Hennepin County, MAC, MNSCU, Met Council, the City of Minneapolis, School Board is now being told, because if this bill passes, you're going to have to increase proportionately your share of this pension bill by a lot of money. In the case of the Park Board, it's 2% of our budget now. Going through the year, by the time it's paid, it's going to be about a 5 or 6 6% increase of our total spending. So we'll have to pay $1 million more. The city is $5.4 million. The school board is $2.3 million. And all of the budgets have been set. The tax levies were done last fall, all predicated on the legislation that passed 2 years ago. And we really think it's very unfair. A deal was struck just 2 years ago that allocated these savings between the state and the employer jurisdictions, and now when it comes to pensions, this bill changes that deal. And it basically, at the end of the day, if the state adopts this, all of the savings will accrue to the state's benefit. And you could do that, you're the legislature, but given the history of how these negotiations happen and how the parties put in money and the reliance that were made, we really think it's very, very unfair. And this issue was heavily litigated or fought over just 2 years ago. We came to what we thought was a fair resolution. Paul Thiessen was involved in it. We understand there are some issues with the budget, but in a time of surplus, really reneging on a pension commission is something, I'm 35 years of lobbying on pensions, I have not seen done. It was, and even at the time, 2 years ago, the director of PARA, Mary Vanek, suggested that it would have been wise for the legislature not even to delve into this issue until there could have been some more certainty, but you did. And basically, the bill before you would change the arrangement that was just made just 2 years ago.
Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just so members are clear, so in the original deal, the city paid $31 million. Under the 2015 deal, the city paid $31 million. Under this bill, the city will pay $31 million. It doesn't change that.
Okay. Other discussion, Representative Hornstein.
Well, thank you. I don't know if we can just wrap this up now, but I don't know if Mr. Ranieri or Mr. Rice would want to respond to that.
If I could,
Mr. Rice, sure.
Mr. Chairman, the deal made last year was that this year the city would pay only $21 million. When the circumstance was presented, Representative Anderson is right. It was $31 million until the consolidation 80% hit. Then there was a discussion. The city agreed to pay. It's not just the city. It's the city, the park board, the school board, Hennepin County, MAC, the airport commission, MNSCU, and three other employer jurisdictions, adding up to $10 million, said, okay, for 2 years, we'll pay $31 million. But the deal the legislature made last year is starting this biennium, starting fiscal year 18, the cities will pay $21, and the state will pay $16. So just to be clear, if you pass this bill tonight, you're reneging on the legislation that was written into law as statutory appropriation, and you're telling all those jurisdictions the letter that PRA gave you in December saying, here's your bill for 17, increase it by your share of $10 million. So you're breaking the deal, in my opinion.
So, Representative Horstein?
Yeah, and I think I'll just emphasize this is really just a question of promises made and promises need to be kept. And again, this money has already been budgeted. So I hope this can be corrected. This is a huge impact for, you know, again, not only the city, but a lot of other entities. So I just wanted to make sure we had that discussion, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much for that.
Sure. And Mr. Rice, if I could just ask for one question. I think, you know, the state has been putting money into the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund for many, 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 many years. And, you know, I think part of the reasoning behind what we did 2 years ago was that, okay, there was a surplus that developed. We've been putting money in for years and years. You know, shouldn't the state be the one who maybe doesn't have to put as much money in since it is the Minneapolis Employee Retirement Fund? You know, if there is additional savings and money available, I guess what's the rationale for the state having to put money in still instead of getting the benefit of those funds, since, again, it is the Minneapolis Employee Retirement Fund and not a state fund?
Mr. Chairman, an extremely fair question. We could go back a long way, as Representative Carlson said, when MRF started, and for many years, MRF was the employer jurisdiction for all the metropolitan government, the sewer system, things like that, the infrastructure, the airport, all the sewer system, MNSCU, even the schools. And the reason was that the cities needed help, and over time there's been this partnership between pension funds and the state. In fact, Commissioner Franz talked about the need for to put in money to pensions. But Minnesota ranks near the bottom. You take all state and local government spending, and only 2% of those state and local government pension costs goes to pensions. The national metric is 4%. You don't put enough money into pensions as it is, and what this, by the, in terms of the partnership and things like that, and the these were arrangements going back to 1978 when the state closed MERV. There was a shared, there was a view that there was a shared responsibility in how to handle these pensions. The state didn't want basic pension members anymore. They wanted people coordinated with Social Security. The cities, all these employers were said, nobody gets the basic pension anymore. They have to be coordinated with Social Security. The new members go into PARA. PARA then picked up their cost, and all the cities around the state shared that obligation. Minneapolis, the MERV plan, was isolated. It got to the point of having some crisis funding. They worked out an arrangement where MERV was basically adopted by PARA and set up as a separate account. And then when it got to 80%, people felt confident enough that we could trigger a consolidation, bring MERV into all of the PARA system so that MERV would not be a burden on anyone else's employer group, your group in St. Paul or Representative David's down in Fillmore County, so that that arrangement could be fair, that people outstate wouldn't say Minneapolis employees are taking our money or diminishing our pensions. And all of these negotiations resulted in this balance that was reached last year when the numbers were recalibrated, and 2 years later, the recalibration is being thrown out the window. And I think we could go back on pension commission hearings, state government finance committee hearings, and everything else on why all these other, we got to where we were. And I think everyone thought this issue was settled 2 years ago in a fair and equitable manner, and with the state getting significant savings from where they were at when the state was at 24 million, and getting reduced down to 6 initially and then down to 16. So it's a matter of how you do it and what you consider fair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Carlson?
No, I was done.
Oh, okay. All right. Other questions for Mr. Rice or Mr. Ranieri? Representative Hornstein.
Well, and I see the state auditors here, and I think that she wanted to briefly testify, so I hope that we can accommodate her.
Okay. We, I guess we weren't notified of her, but if she wants to, I guess we can bring her down.
Thank you for accommodating me, Mr. Chair.
Ways and means.
Thank you so much, Rebecca Otto, the state auditor. I know the hour is very late. My cop, did you get given? Okay. the hour is late. My coffee is worn off, and I will be very, very brief. Representative Garofalo was taking a photo of Representative Anderson and I. I wanted to so I just want to make sure it was good. Thank you to Representative Murphy for acknowledging the cuts to the State Auditor's Office. And the State Auditor's Office is sometimes underappreciated and yet extraordinarily important to overseeing a lot of money that you all pass on to our communities statewide, and especially in greater Minnesota. And my staff works really hard with them every day to make sure they're successful in handling those funds so we don't have bad headlines in your communities. Especially in the smaller communities, when something goes wrong, it's very difficult because everybody knows everybody. And there are cuts to the divisions. I'm not sure what work we won't do with some of the cuts that are going to occur. We are seeing issues with audits being conducted by private firms right now. And the skill set of my staff is needed more now than ever. And we just issued a report the other day called Assessing the Adequacy of 2015 County Audits Performed by Private CPA Firms. And we found over 130 deficiencies in 8 audit reports conducted by private firms on counties. And it's of grave concern to the state. So they're not meeting the standards that are required, national standards. And there's been a lot of statements made that these audits meet the standards, they're the same quality, and they're sufficient, and they're just lower cost. But what we found out now is 130 deficiencies in 8 reports, and 2 of the audit reports for 2 counties will need to be totally redone. I wanted to bring that to your attention because it is a grave concern to the state and to the taxpayers of the state to make sure there is accountability and a strong, independent watchdog that is there on behalf of the people. So I wanted to bring the report to your attention, and we've passed on to the proper oversight authorities who have interest in what's happening in Minnesota.
Thank you. Does anyone have any questions for State Auditor Otto? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Auditor Otto, I represent Roosevelt County, and they told me that they are being subjected to an audit of the audit, and it's going to cost them an additional $5,000. What's your response to that?
State Auditor Otto.
Representative Fabian, who's charging them an additional $5,000?
According to the email that I have, it's my understanding the cost of for the state to examine all the working papers and audit reports will be approximately an additional $5,000 charge for Roosevelt County.
Auditor Otto.
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, we are required by state law to charge for our services. We're also charged with being in charge of overseeing the counties and county finances, and so we are required to charge for desk reviews and work paper reviews of their audit reports.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Auditor Otto, then, do you have some sort of when you make the charges, how do you break those charges out, and can you make that available to me?
Auditor Otto.
Mr. Chair, I can show you the standards we use to review the audit documentation for the audit reports, but it's just staff time reviewing those work papers. I can certainly show you the findings for Roosevelt County and all of the issues that were uncovered with the deficient audit that was conducted on their behalf that they paid for.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, my question is how do you keep the breakdown on $5,000? That's what I'm interested in seeing.
Auditor Otto.
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to follow up with you, Representative Fabian.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Auditor Otto, I'm wondering if you have any opinions on the CPA audits that the city and schools are currently doing.
Auditor Otto.
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, we are in charge of the counties. We've been auditing since the beginning of statehood, and before the state auditor, there was the territorial auditor that oversaw the counties because of the money that flows through them, their identification of property that must be taxed, and the tax money that that flowed through them. So we don't do work paper reviews of the cities or school districts, although you could give us the authority to do that, but you haven't. But the counties are of particular interest and are an area of our authority, and so we are conducting that work on behalf of the people, and I'm deeply disturbed by what we have found.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and Auditor Otto, are you deeply disturbed by the audits that the city and schools are doing?
Auditor Otto.
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, we actually have found issues in some of the city audits. So we don't specifically do work paper reviews, but when we are reviewing the 800, well, we audit Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, but when we're reviewing the audit reports for cities and compare them to the financial reports that they submit to the Office of the State Auditor, we have actually found that some of the reports do not comply with the proper standards again, and it's just really evident on the face of the audit, and so we've had to follow up with the Board of Accountancy on work that's been done that is not in compliance with the standards. And it's their job because they license the CPA firms. So although it's not our focus, I'll just tell you that right now, more than ever, our staff skill set is needed in order to make sure that we're properly overseeing these tax dollars. And the counties spend about $6 billion a year.
Representative Rockwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Otto. So I'm hearing that you do have concerns about the CPA audits the cities and schools are doing right now. Is that correct?
Auditor Otto.
Mr. Chair, there are issues. We've worked cooperatively with these firms for years, and there are always issues, and everyone is always working to do their very best work, but we are disturbed by some of the things that we're currently seeing right now, and I'm not sure why it's so bad. I don't know if there's a lot of low bidding going on. We clearly get what we pay for in Minnesota. Sometimes there are issues with just not having the technical skills and training that they need. And when you get into federal programs and a single audit, it's deeply technical and very difficult. And if you talk to the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, they acknowledge in their reports that there are issues out there with the private audits that are being conducted. And so they're still working to try to figure out how to work out the issues. But again, our office is there to serve the public and taxpayers of Minnesota, and I am concerned. We also have a township that is requesting we audit them. They cannot find a firm interested in auditing them, and so we're going to do that for them, and I understand we'll have another one coming in from a township. The firms are out for a profit, and there isn't a lot of money to be made on these small entities. And so, again, at the end of the day, the Office of the State Auditor is there. We have the technical skill set, and we have excellent staff, and we don't have a profit motive.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Auditor Otto, it seems to me when I was at the Pension Commission that there was some difficulty with the auditor, State Auditor's Office and the Is it the Elberly Fire Department? Are you familiar with that?
Auditor Otto.
Mr. Chair, no, we don't audit them. But there was a statement made that we audit them, we don't.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Auditor Otto. Well, I understood that you audited the relief associations.
Auditor Otto.
Mr. Chair, no, we don't. They're audited by private firms.
Mr. Chair and Auditor, so you don't do any oversight of the relief associations?
Auditor Otto.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, they're audited by private firms. They report their financial information and investment information to the office. We make sure they've completed all of that, and then we, if they have, we certify them for their 2% money or fire state aid.
Chair Anderson.
I can maybe help out Representative Vogel. So we heard about this in the Pension Commission, and what the issue was is the City of Albert Lea was informed by the State Auditor's Office that they didn't have to do these certain steps as part of a volunteer fire relief pension fund. And they didn't find out until 3 years later that they were calculating things wrong, and then they were delivered a hefty bill to pay for this, and Representative Poppy has a bill to correct the situation because otherwise the city would be paying a whole chunk of money, and they were not told for 3 years from the state auditor on the issue. And I can get you more details on that too if that's helpful.
Auditor Otto.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel. So we actually do this oversight work, and the city is responsible for knowing the laws. The former Pension Commission Director did some cleanup of statutes, and the City of Albert Lea was not aware of those changes, which they're required to be aware of. When we become aware of an issue that is not in compliance with the law, we can't certify for aid. So that's the situation. And the City of Albert Lea has additional information, and there's copies of the letters they received. And the Pension Commission is just deciding whether they're going to have them pay the money over to the relief, which they have coming to them. The funds that they're holding were for a purpose that has expired. So, but they're responsible for that. We are not there to hold their hands, but we're there to make sure that they have followed the laws.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Auditor. So then, what is the responsibility? I understood there was some involvement, and I'm just wondering what your responsibility is, because I would assume that there's some responsibility there and possibly some remuneration that's being either paid for by them or by the auditor's office.
Auditor Otto.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, our job as the office is the legislature. We're there to make sure that before any entity receives additional state funds, whether it be local government aid, fire state aid, that we ensure that they have completed their audits, that they have completed the financial reporting forms, that they haven't paid out pensions if it's fire reliefs. We have to make sure they pay them out properly, and if there are any issues, we don't certify them for aid. The fact that the Pension Commission Director changed a statute within the PARA statutes, and it was more of a PARA issue, when we became aware of that, we, in good conscience, could not certify them for the aid. So that's the work. That's what we do, and it's our responsibility to do that is the way the laws are written.
Chair Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I just want to correct, it's the City of Austin, and it was for 3 years that the State Auditor's Office certified them at the wrong aid amount, and now the city has to pay.
That's not right.
Auditor Otto.
Mr. Chair, it's not that we certified them for the wrong amount of aid. the Department of Revenue determines the amount of aid. It's that the City of Albert Lea did not pay over the correct amount to the Relief Association. We don't do that work for them. So I'm happy to provide, Representative Vogel, if you want the documentation, I can send that to you. I'm happy to provide that. But I do know the work of the office. My staff knows their work as well, and I can assure you that we're making sure that they're following. Any, if we find issues, we become aware of issues. We will not certify until those issues are rectified.
Well, it sounds, Adorado, that you do know quite a bit about this situation with Albert Lea. So, yeah, why don't you provide that material to, Representative Vogel.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any other questions, Representative Vogel?
Not really, Mr. Chair. I just was curious because, obviously, if we're going to be oversighting the auditors, the private firms, then if indeed the state auditor might have some issues that they're facing with some of the work they're doing, maybe there has to be some oversight there, too.
Any other questions? Representative Draskowski and Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Adorado, are you going to make public the concerns that you have with the counties, or can you share those with the committee and certainly Chair Anderson?
Auditor Otto.
Mr. Chair and Representative Draskowski, I'd be happy to, and I'll give you a copy of this if you would like. And it's got the 130 deficiencies that we found in terms of not following the national standards. And also the counties that are going to have their audits totally redone, as well as five counties that are going to have their reports reissued after additional work has to be conducted by the firm. So I'm happy to get the report to the whole committee. And if you have additional questions, please let me know. But it is a grave concern for us.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Auditor Otto, another question. What's the desk review?
Auditor Otto.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, at 11:07 at night. A desk review is more of a high-level review, and we do those of the audits of the counties that we're currently not auditing. And it's just looking at the reports to make sure they're complying with the standards of their gap report. And so that's a higher-level review. When you do audit documentation review or what we call a work paper review, that's much more in-depth. And what you're looking at is the underlying documentation that the national standards require that really basically show your work in terms of determining major programs for the federal programs and the single audit and many, many other things. And so an auditor who is unfamiliar with the audit should be able to go in and review the audit documentation to understand exactly what the audit firms carried out. And it must reflect the requirements of the national standards set by a whole bunch of national standard-setting bodies. And so this report is pretty nice because it'll tell you exactly what the authoritative guidance is and then what was the failure of what wasn't done. And it's a little bit dry, but important, and it's all tied back to the authoritative guidance.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, and again, so if you do a desk review, then for some reason you do the full-blown audit. Again, Roseau County is concerned because they got charged $1,155 for a desk review. You went through that, and then an additional $5,000 charge for the full-blown audit. Can you get me the breakdown of how you arrive at the $1,155 charge for the desk review, please?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I'm happy to do that for you. I would contend that the more efficient system would be to have us conducting all the audits, but this is the current system because of cuts in 2003 that the legislature imposed on the office, even though the audit division gives nothing to the state general fund because we're required to charge for services. But I'm more than happy to follow up with you on those.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Auditor Otto, have you, since the change in law, have you put together a report on the number of FTEs that you have and the number you've decreased and how they've been reassigned, et cetera? Is there anything like that available for this body?
Auditor Otto.
Mr. Chair, I know it's really late now. Representative Draskowski, you mean going back maybe from 2003 until present? And if so, yes, there's budget documents that will reflect the FTEs, and I'm, again, happy to get you that documentation if you'd like.
Thank you.
Sure.
Other discussion? Well, thank you, Auditor Otto.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
All right. Is there any other discussion to the bill? Seeing none. Any last closing comments, Chair Anderson?
Thank you for your time and consideration.
Okay. Chair Anderson renews her motion that Senate File 605 as amended be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Senate File 605 as amended is referred to the General Register. Okay, members, we will have a meeting tomorrow night, time to be announced on the floor to take up the Health and Human Service bill. With that, we are adjourned.